Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the first new episode of The Matt Rich Podcast. It's a new podcast. I'm kind of revamping my old one, changing the name, new format and everything like that. Today, my first guest I have on is my old friend, Alex Momcilovich.
Hello.
How's it going, man?
Great.
Thank you for coming on today on this gloomy Sunday.
Yeah, it is a gloomy Sunday.
How you been?
Good.
Yeah?
I'm good.
So, you all have your own podcast. Tell me a little about yourself before we just jump into things. Like, tell the people, like, you know, paint a little picture about yourself.
Well, I guess the most important thing that kind of stands out for me is that I am a person in long-term recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. So I've been clean for like 4.5 years. And it is an important thing for me because the rest of my life before that was just characterized by just doing drugs and alcohol and like the lifestyle. So I think that's an important part. And then a little bit about me is that really since I've been in recovery, now I work as a recovery coach. I spent a lot of years working at a sports facility and working with kids and stuff, which was a beautiful thing for me to do to kind of give back. And it was like a spiritual thing for me because I was never around people's kids or families or anything like that. So it was really beautiful for me to be teaching sports to like 2 to 6 year old kids and them like That's seeing cool. you as their hero and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That was cool. And then now I kind of, that's what I work on. And then as you know, I have I have my own YouTube channel and everything under my name, Becoming Nobody, Alex Momcilovich, where I talk about different, some addiction recovery stuff, but more stuff related to philosophy, religion, spiritual practice, spiritual growth, and ideas, because that's really the journey that I've been on since I got clean and sort of had a spiritual awakening. And I realized I was kind of, I had a knack for like understanding and explaining those things to others, which is why I enjoy doing it. So I kind of went from there.
Motivated you to start the YouTube channel?
Yeah.
Kind of like what I motivated me as well, like just speaking your opinions and stuff, but trying to help people with, you know, how you get through stuff.
Yeah, that's the idea, helping people.
That's awesome. That's what really, that's what kind of made me like, made me notice you again, like on social media, made me see you on my feed all the time when you started posting all this stuff about your, not only your recovery, but your, I would call it almost like self-help and like Buddhism like teachings and all these things that you do. I like to listen to those, and it's really cool, kind of the message you're giving out. And from, because we go way back in high school, you know? So
yeah, part or of the things that middle school a little bit.
Yeah, middle school, I think, right? It is middle school.
Oh, when we first met, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I admire about seeing people progress is when you see someone who has changed so drastically, you know, and for the better, like you.
Yeah.
You know, like, we were all troublemakers back in high school, you included, and just, you know, the reason I wanted you on here today, too, was not only because, you know, I think you have a lot to talk about with a lot of different things, but your recovery process is something that I think a lot of people out here struggle with, and we live in a place where opioids is like the leading, you know, cause of death in this area.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, I think that you can reach a lot of people and have a lot of advice that you could share, because you said you've been sober for 4.5 years.
Yeah, 4.5. November 10th was 4.5 years. So yeah,
wow,
this month.
That's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy. But like, tell me, I kind of want to focus on that right now. Like, if I can, if we could talk about some of your recovery, I would love to like get into all of it. Like, for instance, what, like, let's start from the beginning. What started you into, like, what led you into doing drugs? And how hard did you get? Because like, some people say they do drugs and they smoke weed and drink a little bit here and there. Like, what were you like? What were you considering that you're now sober from?
Yeah, I would like to talk about that because sometimes in recovery settings, you can't really get into as much detail. But I think what got me into it is I was actually very pampered as a kid. Like my mom, I was very spoiled, like to the point where I threw up going to preschool, like, and cried because I didn't want to be separated from my mom. So I was actually kind of like, if like a psychologist was looking at me, I was kind of messed up as like that age kid, because I wouldn't even hang out with other kids in preschool, only the teacher. And I wanted to so bad, but I was just weird in the way to say it. Like, I was so afraid. Like, I was, like, very self-conscious.
Yeah.
So it kind of started there. And then I remember even in first grade, just real quick, like, I wanted to play kickball so bad, and I was afraid to play. Like, this one kid would take every other day off of kickball to hang out with me at the playground. And I wanted to play so bad, but he just would hang out with me because I was afraid to play. His name was Nick Ovanek. You might actually know who that is. Yeah, and so that first grade, yeah, he would play with me, and I always remember that. So that was kind of – so people liked me, and I had a caring family, but I was felt weird on the inside, right? So I went into middle school, and before I started picking up drugs, like 6th, 7th grade, I started – getting other, like, very devious behavior. Like, I was very aggressive. I would bully kids on the bus and stuff. And no matter what, if they were, like, mentally challenged, I would bully them. If they were older than me, like, I'd be bullying kids in high school. I didn't care. I would just start stuff with everybody and do a lot of, like, vandalism around the town.
That's when I met you.
Yeah.
In those days, yeah.
Yeah.
Troublemaker kid.
Yeah, and it was, like, and pretty extreme. You know, I know kids like egg and teepee houses, but we would do it every night, and I'd walk around, like, cutting people's cars and slashing their tires and spray painting stuff at, like, the town baseball fields and, like, the parks and just for no reason, you know, like, shooting fireworks at people's houses. So that was before I did drugs. So you're kind of with me so far?
Yeah, yeah, wow.
Yeah, and that was kind of around when I met you. Yeah, and, like, getting into fights with people. I remember when we first met, it was, like,
our groups clashed.
Yeah, the Hanover and, like, Central people wanted to fight.
Enemies.
And I remember this guy, Will Rogers, like, punched me in the face and, like, knocked me out. And that was, and after that, and that was interesting, that was, like, one of the first times. But, you know, and after that, I got in tons of fights throughout my life after that before I got clean. But, so I was 13 and I got back into school and, my friend Evan was like, hey, man, you gotta, like, try getting high. Like, it was really good. And I had already been doing really weird things. Like, me and my friends would smoke, like, nerds and candy wrapped up in paper and stuff.
Yeah, so it was a gateway. I was over, like, it was inevitable.
Yeah, it was, like, for some reason I was, like, moving towards that. But no, so it happened really fast. So I got high, and, like, within a week or two, me and my friend Tyler were, like, we're going to start selling drugs. So I started selling weed and trying to get people to get high. And right away, like, my drug dealers were older, so they were had all these other drugs too. So I was doing, right away I was like taking some Vicodin and some Xanax, and I was drinking a lot and pretty much whatever I can get my hands on. I did cocaine right away, although I think it wasn't real. And yeah, and I didn't know. So no, it happened quick though. Within like a few months, I got a gun pulled on me behind like the ice arena in St. John. Yeah, by like a 20-something-year-old man trying to rob me. And
you
I was
went
like,
from smoking nerds kid. To getting a gun pointed at you in like 2 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? Yeah. So it was
you jumped in head first.
Not normal, especially growing up in St. John, which is like a really nice neighborhood, you know, like that my mom would have freaked out if she knew that. And then they were texting her off my phone because they stole it when they did that. And like crazy things. But no, my progression was pretty quick. So that same first few months when I started using, like, that was in October, like that winter, I remember doing Suboxone, and it was like a stop sign, and the guy was like, take a quarter of this and don't drink. And my friend and me, we took a whole one each and we got really drunk. And I remember sitting in this backyard all night, and like,
he said, don't take a whole one and don't drink, and you did the exact opposite.
Yeah, we got really drunk and took a whole one, and we came back from this party, and my other friend's reading. He's like, you guys should go to the hospital. That could be, like, deadly. And we're literally, I mean, I know I almost died that night. I was laying there all night drinking out of a hose, like, throwing up over and over and over, and actually, I had a few out-of-body experiences. Like, I would puke and feel like I was going to die, and then I would be above myself watching my body laying there and, like, floating upwards and seeing my friends still, like, puking. And then I would, like, go back into the body and have, like, a breath of air. And it happened.
Dude.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That's really scary.
So I remember that, like, as clear as day. And, you know, and it was, like, in real time and everything. And so I know even that night I was, like, close probably to death,
yeah.
I would assume.
It sounds like a lot of near-death experience, like, people that experience that. Where the heart stops or something, and they experience seeing themselves above themselves.
Yeah, because basically it could
sounds
lead to like
that.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
So you that was like in high school, you're saying?
That was in eighth grade.
Eighth grade.
Yeah.
So high school was even worse.
Yeah, the summer between 8th grade and high school, I got arrested with like a 20-something-year-old guy that used to live in these apartments. Or no, we used to get drugs from these apartments, and we had a half pound of weed and a half ounce of cocaine and a bunch of acid. We were going to the beach, and the cops were like, "What are you doing, man?" It was in Dyer. I was like a little kid. I hid my personal drugs like down my pants, and he took the blame because it was his, and he was an adult, and I was like 13.
Wow.
But I remember they were like, "You could have got charged. Like, you're so lucky he's taking the blame," and they didn't find my stuff, and my parents had to pick me up, and I didn't care at all, you know. I kept buying drugs from him when he got out of jail. Like, it didn't make any difference. Yeah.
So that was like your finishing up middle school, transferring into high school.
Yeah.
So you basically came in high school almost a convicted felon.
Yeah, almost.
You missed that by a little bit, right?
Yeah, I didn't get in trouble, and that was a theme. Like, I always got away with things.
So at high school time, what were you, like, what kind of drugs were you consistently doing by high school?
When I was in high school, I was taking, first of all, I was selling a lot of drugs, like thousands of pills every week and like tons of weed. So I was basically hanging out with my friend in his basement, and we would just...
Can you get in trouble for saying this if it's the past?
No, I don't think so. No, definitely not. Definitely not.
That was over 10 years ago, too.
Yeah. No, I'm not worried about that. But yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah, so we were selling like thousands of dollars of drugs, you know, per week. And yeah, I did a lot. I would take 10 to 20 Xanax bars a day.
Wow.
And which people thought was... And I could drink... We'd split a half gallon of vodka, of Smirnoff, or I could drink my own half gallon to myself.
Holy shit.
And yeah, like if I was at home... And people think that's crazy. As an adult, like I see in treatment, alcoholics come in, like grown adults, and they're like, "Oh, I drink almost a fifth a day." And I remember like... being 14 and drinking like a half gallon of vodka.
Wow, dude.
Yeah, and so, and everything else too. I was smoking weed all the time, taking, not really cocaine yet, but like Vicodin and stuff like that. But yeah, that was what my whole day consisted of. It was just like, I got high in school, I sold drugs in school, at home, and I just loved the lifestyle. I loved just bagging it up and selling it and making the money and blowing the money, and it became, it kind of became sad, though, as high school went on, because even though it seemed cool, it was like a lot of people were getting older and doing fun things and going to parties, and we didn't even really go to parties, you know? We would just sit in the basement and get high.
Yeah.
And I was so violent, people wouldn't really want me at parties, because when I'd go, I'd always beat somebody up and stuff, you know? And I'd always get fights. Something. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, it's so shocking to me, because you're like... the exact opposite of this person now.
Yeah.
Like I'm enjoying this story because it's so crazy, the turnaround, and I'm waiting to hear what the fuck changed you. Like, that's what's most mind-boggling of all, because how many people who basically have these habits as a kid who go down these paths get away from that?
I think it's...
not a lot.
I think it's very, very few, yeah.
Yeah.
Even the Surgeon General's did a report in 2016 that's like 1 in 10 substance abuse people ever even seek help, and in that, like 1 to 3 make it to a year clean. So basically it's like 1 to 3% of like people with substance abuse issues stay clean, which is extremely low, you know,
extremely low. So how did you do this? Like, how did you get the motivate? What changed your mind after like high school? What was the big moment to start getting you sober?
The last thing before I get to that, I should probably finish my little bit after high school.
Okay.
Because it wasn't quite, because I got graduated at 17, because I was expelled, and I got expelled sometimes. I got to finish early somehow, like a semester early. Even though I was...
They're just like, get them out of here.
Yeah, and all my friends were great above me, and they left, so I was like, I'm out of here, and they let me finish somehow.
Wow.
And I always got good grades. That's another thing I just want to touch on. Like, I was super smart until my addiction started taking hold. But, like, as a little kid, I was always, like, the smartest kid in the class. Like, I could do all the times tables, and, like, I always got an A, and I didn't have to read or study a lot. Like, I knew a lot. So I was, like, a really good reader and really good at math. And that deteriorated. And so just a couple things to touch on. Marijuana was a huge thing for me, too. I don't always talk about it because it's like a given. But I smoked a lot of weed too, always, every day for years, you know, huge amounts. But so I finished high school and I get, like, my parents kicked me out, but they didn't make me leave. They helped me get an apartment in Maryville and stuff. They didn't just, like, kick me out on my own.
Yeah.
So Maryville, I lived my last 3 years in an apartment in a house, and things were even worse there because I started hanging out more with, like, gang members and stuff, and I got into guns, and I would get real paranoid, and you know, at the end of my addiction, I was got addicted to promethazine and codeine. I was drinking personal use about $1,000 a week of codeine syrup.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and it really, you know.
Is that something you have to buy? Like, you couldn't get a script for all that.
Yeah, no, you can buy it on the streets for, like, a lot of money.
Damn.
Yeah, I don't know.
Get barrels or something at Costco? That's a lot.
It's a lot of money, yeah.
Wow.
I was drinking, it was, you know, at that point, I'd be on, like, 7 or 8 different drugs at a time. Like, I'd be doing lines with bath salt and cocaine and Vicodins and Percocets crushed up. Like, and I remember people being like, you're gonna have, like, a heart attack. Like, you're out. And I'd be like, I'm on 8 drugs right now, you know?
Wow.
Like, yeah, so that was, and that was, like, every day, man. And I was doing, the drug dealing was getting kind of crazy, too. Like, I had done a huge drug trip to Alabama and almost got arrested in, like, to Colorado. And so my lifestyle was, intertwined with that too, you know. Like, I started robbing people, I had a lot of violence too. I would concord with that before recovery. Yeah. Like, I don't know if that's something you want me to touch on a little bit, but sure. It was like,
what, your violence?
Yeah. I mean, it was just anything. Like, I would strangle people, beat people up, tase people, and people were afraid of me. Some I scarred really bad, and I just had yeah, I was just so emotionally unstable from all the drugs I did, you know?
Yeah.
And I think I already had an inherent anger tendency, so I just...
You think the drugs were fueling it?
Yeah, because I would just do so many. I would just go crazy, and I had no, like, emotional stability, so I couldn't argue. Like, I'd sit at a party, and if there was someone I didn't like, and they could be doing just their attitude at the party. It didn't even have to be towards me. I couldn't, like, go talk to them or argue with them. I would just sit there silently, and then all of a sudden attack them, and they'd be like... Why I don't even know why you did that. Like, why didn't you tell me? And that's how, like, messed up I was, you know?
See, it's like, I think a lot of people, some people can relate to that. I think a lot of it was probably fueled, like you said, by, like, a lot of the drugs that you were, 8 different drugs you were on and stuff like that. but people have that same type of stuff, but in different degrees.
Yeah.
All different levels. And, you know, like, their anger... A lot of people holding their anger or lash out in different ways and different things. Maybe they're not aggressive, but they say mean shit, or they act out doing stupid shit, you know? Like,
yeah.
I think that's also where I'm assuming where your advice is going to come into play. You know,
yeah, and I think, too, like...
How the fuck you keep that demon away?
Yeah, and I think, like, in Buddhism, it's all about the intention. So I think, really, it is about your intentions of mind. Like, that's what attracts and creates all your karma. So it really doesn't even matter if you're acting out on it, you know? Like, if it's arising in your mind, it's still going on. Like, that's why they say, basically, you can kill people in thought and like, in an intention rather than... even if you don't physically act out on it, it's like the intention is... basically what it's all about, you know? So I do think a lot of people have that. They just might not act on it, but they still have that rage all the time, or, like, that anger or resentment. So, yeah, just to kind of finish up my addiction, the last 6 months I was, like, couldn't stop. You know, that's the characteristic of addiction. No matter what you use or how bad or not bad it is, it's not even about that. It's about, like, what happens when you do, like, can you stop? And I couldn't stop. I'd do the drugs I didn't even like doing. You know, I had done so many party drugs, like ecstasy and stuff in high school, that by the time I was out, if I took one, I thought I was going to die. And I would do it anyway. Like, I couldn't say no. You know, like, if somebody had it, I'd be like, I had to take it. You know, if it was in front of me, I had to take it. If I had homework to do and I wasn't going to do any cocaine tonight or until tonight, and I walked downstairs and someone's doing it in the morning, I would do it immediately. Like, I didn't have any ability not to use this. I remember,
you had no self-control?
No, definitely not. And I remember this guy, and I'll touch on that too in a second, but I remember this guy, they used to come over every morning, and he had a ton of money, and he would just show up and want to do coke all day, and I hated it, because I didn't like how it made me feel, and I knew I was going to waste my whole day doing it and get nothing done, and I didn't like it, but I could never say no, I would just do it, you know, even though I hated it. And that was like, even if a drug made me almost want to die the night before, I would do it again. But yeah, I think that's the mistake that a lot of people make trying to get clean, is they think that, I'll get to recovery more in a sec, but they think that it's about willpower. And like in the NA and AA literature, it stresses a lot that like willpower alone won't keep us clean for any substantial amount of time, because it's not, it's about like surrender and having a spiritual awakening rather than about willing ourselves to get clean. Because if I could have done that, I would have stopped a long time ago. So like a lot of people that don't,
just like straight discipline, like I'm just gonna quit right now, cold turkey.
Yeah, a lot of people that don't understand addiction think that, or people that can't stop for long. But like if you talk to anyone that's in long-term recovery, they'll tell you that it's not about like that. What do you mean, like white knuckling it and fighting it and being like, it's just the will.
You have to find purpose to quit and want, like you have to, and yeah. And that's basically caused by what, like a magic aha moment.
Yeah, and like in Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, which is basically the most successful of methods for recovery that there is, it's about that they give you this way that the 12 steps that they say, and it's true, if you work these and practice them, then you'll have a spiritual awakening, and that will like relieve your desire to drink and use, so you could stay clean and sober. Wow. And find purpose, like you said.
Interesting.
Rather than just trying to like quit on my own and force it and live the same life with the same set of thoughts and just take away the drug, you know.
Because they say that, I know that it makes so much sense, because I know that spiritual awakenings in any sort of sense for any purpose, like people who have like a psychedelic spiritual awakening or a near-death experience or just from any type of moment or life experience, right? Like surviving an accident or something like that, like having a loved one pass away. Having a spiritual awakening can reset the way that you were programmed before.
Yeah.
That's what's so cool about them. It's a shortcut instead of this years of therapy or like grinding away. It's like that aha epiphany to where you can't see it, you can't unsee it and unfeel it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and yeah, I think it could
I've had
happen,
those different things in my life, but not with
you have littler
substances
ones too.
Yeah.
I think it could happen from, yeah, like you said, anything, whether it's from like meditation, a death, being in jail for a long time, psychedelics, whatever, being alone in the desert, any event that happens. But yeah, and that's what I want to touch on too. I'll just finish my last like couple months of addiction, and then I could tell you about my spiritual awakening that I had, because it's different than most people in recovery. I was just super paranoid at that. I had this big AR-15 assault rifle, and I'd sleep with it in my bed, like basically hugging it. And I'd wake up at night and like run outside and be like, "Who's there?" And you know, everyone in my house just sold drugs for me. We all had guns. It was a very paranoid environment. You know, so many people were out to get me. It was not cool. I wouldn't sleep well. I had really bad anxiety. My insides were messed up. Like I would either have to go to the bathroom as soon as I ate before I was even done, or I wouldn't go for days, and then it'd be like terrible when I did, or like it was bad. And I remember girls in the middle of the night would tell me like, "Hey, like I had to start slapping you, you stopped breathing and stuff."
Wow.
And I would like chuckle and be like, "Oh yeah," like, you know, I didn't not believe them. I don't know, that's just what I was on, you know. And so it culminated, we started doing even crazier and crazier things, and I actually started losing even my good friends were distancing themselves a little bit. Some of my really good friends I'd even, like, attack when I was with them. Like, not attack, but, like, punch them in the face or, like, slap them, because I was getting so delusional.
Wow.
And I went to someone's house that just owed me, like, a small amount of money, and it ended up just beating them up pretty bad. But, and it wasn't, like, my intention to, like, kill them or something, but I did have a knife, so they charged, like, originally attempted murder, but then it went down to like armed robbery, assault with a deadly weapon. And it wasn't actually, to be honest, a robbery was never the intention or anything. It was just like beating the person up, but that was like the charges, you know.
Yeah.
So that was when I got clean, because I went to jail for just a couple days and stuff, in and out, and I still couldn't stop, and I went to rehab because my lawyer told me to. So I still got high the day I left. Like, I smoked weed the day I left. But I had my spiritual awakening in rehab, and this is where it's, like, different, because most people in recovery don't have it like that. Like, Bill Wilson, the guy who wrote the AA Big Book, he had an epiphany like this, and then he just stopped, and then he figured out this method for other people to do it. But for me...
Interesting. So it really is a method to make an epiphany, in a sense. For your alcoholism.
Yeah, the steps, yeah.
It's so fascinating. I never thought of it.
I would say
like
so. Yeah, wow. I would say so.
Cool. Keep going, sorry.
No, for sure. But most people, it's very, very gradual, and they struggle a lot. Mine was just... it was just like a grace thing or like a karma thing where I just woke up a couple of days into treatment and I felt totally different. And I'm not saying I've been perfect by any means or haven't struggled since, but I woke up and I knew that I was going to be clean. And I like didn't resent any, and I'm not saying resentments never came back, but I didn't resent anybody anymore. I thought about everything completely different. I was like, I gotta make amends to all these people. It was like I had been, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like I had been locked in some kind of like cage, and without my own doing it just like opened, like I was in some kind of like veil where I couldn't see anything, you know? Wow. And it just like opened and I had like a whole new like plane of consciousness that I was kind of on.
Yeah, like you were keeping in a cage.
Yeah.
Like subdued by drugs and stuff.
Yeah, and then I read two books in rehab, The Powers of Your Subconscious Mind, which was by like Dr. Robert or John Murphy, that someone gave me, and it was like the universe, everything happens for a reason. This girl gave me it like 6 months before, and I never was gonna read it, and somehow it ended up with me in rehab. And whoa. Then yeah, and so that was interesting. I mean, obviously I must have packed it, but I don't know, like, yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then this guy gave me a book in there, and he had been from the same town as me, and he gave me a book that he got at a concert from like a swami, and it was called The Science of Self-Realization by this Swami Prabhupada, who brought like this Hare Krishna movement to the United States, a chanting movement earlier in the 1960s. Like, and I read those two in rehab, and I was like, wow, like it really opened my mind up, you know? And he, in that book, he kept talking about reading the Bhagavad Gita, which is like one of the holiest text in like India and Hinduism. Mm-hmm. So I read it as soon as I got out of rehab, and that was all like the start of my change in spiritual awakening. So I started realizing that there was like a lot more to life, or there was a lot more, like how I thought it was wasn't exactly how it was, you know.
Wow. So like in rehab that night, that morning that you woke up, like the morning you woke up and just had that change, right? What led up to that? What happened the night before? Were you all up in your head thinking about stuff?
No.
Telling yourself tomorrow's going to be different? Like, what changed?
No, nothing happened that made it happen. I don't think that's how it works. It just kind of happened. But what I did do was follow it up with a lot of action, because I know other people have those experiences too, and then they still end up using it again, you know?
Like,
yeah, and sometimes they call it like a pink cloud in recovery. Like, you get on the pink cloud and you're like, this is amazing, I never want to use again, and they don't take any follow-up action, and then that wears off and dies, and you do use again, you know? So like, I think those experiences are important, but I think they still have to be followed up. So I didn't do anything to get it, I don't think, but I did a lot of work afterwards. It to keep it.
So it's all about, it's a mixture of both. And another question is, like, every day I'm assuming you have to, or do you? Is it not even a part of you anymore? Or is that something that you have to, like, push? Is it the addiction to, like, go back to anything? Or be angrier or lash out? Is that something you have to, like, push down every day?
It's definitely there. I don't know if I'd say push down, because I don't want to be, like, suppressing, you know, where it's like that, but in a sense I do get what you're saying. It's like what I did was I went to recovery meetings every day for like the first 2 years. And like a big thing they say is like go to 90 in 90 days, and I did that a lot of times, and I was every day in a meeting, like taking people, helping people, doing all the service. And I still go to like 3 meetings a week, so I still do that. But yeah, recovery, I think it's definitely something that you work on. Like they say, it's contingent on the maintenance of your spiritual condition. There is people that get clean and do recovery programs and then stop and stay clean on their own. There's not very many, though. A lot of them eventually go back, or they like are what's called dry drunks. Like they're clean and sober, but they're self-willing it, so they're not, like, really happy and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's still there. I mean, sometimes I, like, won't think about using for a long, long time. Like, in the beginning, I didn't think about it ever. I was like, I'm never going to use again. But then once life kicks in and stuff, yeah, there's been times where I've went. I remember one winter I went, like, months just lamenting that I couldn't drink lean anymore, and when my old friends would text me, like, oh yeah, you guys are lucky. And so I think you do have to have a good recovery base, because they say that addiction's a disease, and we could look up the definition, but a lot of people are like, oh, it's not, and like, how could it be a disease? There's a big argument, and I don't think it's that important whether, like, how you view it, but I do know that most people that are clean say it is, and people that are still using say it's not. So that's what I think is interesting.
Really?
Yeah, like, people that are using will be like, no, it's not. I could stop when I want. But people that are clean will be like, are the people that realize, like, this is an illness, I have to treat it. Just like if I had cancer or diabetes, if I didn't treat it, of course, it's not going to get better.
Interesting. You know? But is it something like, so my perspective, and from, like, a perspective of someone who maybe needs recovery or needs to get into something like that, is it something that, like, so you're in it 4.5 years, is it something that you, like, what I meant by, like, suppress more of, like, is it always going to be a part of you? Does it always feel like it's a part of you, or do you more feel like that was your past self, and, like, you don't need drugs to have good times anymore, you don't need drugs to be your identity, to build your identity around? Like, do you feel like that is something that's separate from you now?
In that way, yeah.
Or do you actually have to, like, kind of fight the urge every day? Because we often fight the urge every day to, like, be a good person. No one's just naturally just, like, a good person. Everyone's got to be outgoing, and you have to be kind to others, right? So that's something we all have to be mindful of, to practice. But the other, like, but addiction and stuff, is that also something, like, every day you have to go to battle with?
I think for some people it is, and those are the people that usually, you know, if they don't have that spiritual awakening, they will go back to people that are like, I have to do this because I get in too much trouble, or I'd lose my wife and kids, and, like, I really want to use, and I would if I could, but, like, I can't because I'll get, you know, I really would, but, like, I just can't because of my life. It's not like that for me, where I don't want to, like, get high or anything. Sometimes I do in my thoughts if I'm deluded, like I said, but I'm free from it in that sense. Like, that's the idea, where I don't want, I don't miss, like, I don't want to live that lifestyle again. I don't think, like, oh, I wish I could go to bars, or I wish I could hang out with people that drink and use, or anything like that. That I feel that I'm free from, but I think you could always go back to it, and that's how people relapse, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I think if I didn't work on my recovery, there's always a chance that you could start. You know, I've had to really change my life to an extent where my inner intentions are about spiritual growth and realizing a God of my understanding, or my relationship with the universe, whatever you want to call it. Because if that wasn't, I'm like a hardcore addict, man. So, like, if that wasn't my intention, I don't think I could be one of those people that just, like, some people get clean and they pretty much, they're happy and they're content just living a normal life. And, they don't want to use anymore, and they're like, oh, good, I could save my money now, or, like, have kids, or, like, take care of my shit. I'm not like that. Like, I feel like really an addict in the sense that if I didn't have something much grander, like, I'd probably be like, fuck it, I'm just going to go get high again.
So purpose is what really keeps you.
Yeah, otherwise I just wouldn't, you know, like, I don't think I could be just like, oh, cool, I have a house and a job and a girlfriend. Like, I don't know, I'd probably still, like, because I use no matter what, you know, like, so I do need, yeah, I'd say, but, like, purpose for sure.
That, and, you know, I've had podcasts in the past with people like this about different, like, topics with self-help and stuff, and it all comes back to the same thing, purpose. Like, to finding purpose in things checks a lot of boxes off that we don't know are, like, empty in us, you know? And one of them being, I think, addiction. Like, if you find purpose in things, some people find it in their family and doing it for their children, or some people find it in doing it because their job or career. Some people need other external motivation, other things that motivate them to stay clean. And for you, it sounds like what you practice, your meditation, your mindfulness, all your spirituality, like, it seems like that is your avenue to keep you to keep it at bay and to keep you, like, on a good path. Which I think, like, I'm thinking of, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of people who are struggling, people who are you or were you, who don't know where to go and stuff like that. And, like, you know, if spirituality saved you, and I'm assuming so many other people, what do you do every day to, like, kind of remind yourself that you're not that person anymore? Do you wake up and do you meditate? Do you, like, what is your,
yeah,
do you do any daily things that help you with that?
Yeah, like, one thing is that I think for that people, what they don't understand about trying to get clean is that it is extremely difficult for a lot of people, and it takes a lot of work. So a lot of people right away aren't willing to do that, where they're like, people come in, like, on fire is a good example they call in recovery. Like, you come in on fire, like, they say, like, your ass is on fire, like, you're in a bunch of trouble, like, you want to stop, like, whatever, internally, externally, like, your life's screwed up. They'll do anything for, like, a week or a month, but they don't have the perseverance or the dedication. So as soon as they get a little better, they're like, oh, well, you know, like, this drug was never a problem for me, or, like, this drink, or, like, I don't got to do this anymore. So, yeah, I do think it can't be underestimated, the difficulty and, like, the persistence needed, for sure. And then, like, there's also a lot of people that don't want to hear anything about spirituality or spiritual growth. And I wasn't into that before recovery, besides, like, when I would do psychedelics and have some certain experiences, although I feel like I wasted a lot of them just being an idiot. Mm-hmm. But one thing is, recovery is, like, you don't need to, even if you don't, like, you don't want to not join recovery because you don't like that kind of stuff. You could come in wherever you're at and talk about where you're at and just rely on the group, and people are very open-minded and accepting. Nobody's going to tell you, like, you got to believe this or you're leaving. Like, that's not what it's about at all. But a lot of people think that it's going to be like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so, like, that's one thing I have to stress, is it's not, like, don't be like, oh, I don't believe in God, so I'm not getting clean. Like, that's not how it works. It's okay, you know. But for me, it's man, if I don't work on myself, I could go down really quick mentally and stuff, where I'm just, like, kind of living unconsciously. So what I do is I go to a couple of recovery meetings a week, where I do whatever we're studying or talking about topics in the meeting, where I get to share honestly and openly where I'm at, and then I have the energy of other people gathered for a common purpose, like sharing their pain and suffering and their joy and their hope. So that's
trying to do the same goal, right? You guys are all working towards the same thing.
Yeah, it reminds me, like, in the Bible, Jesus says, like, where two or more are gathered in my name, I'm there amongst them. And then in, like, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, they talk about that, and they say, like, when two or more people put their mind on the same intention, it, like, manifests quicker and easier and stuff. So I think recovery is kind of like that, being around other people with the same intention. But yeah, I do a lot of people in recovery do prayer. I do some prayer. I do a lot of meditation, for sure. And that's been one for me, as I've studied a lot of different spiritual literature, and not just the intellectual knowledge, but, like, practice, application, meditation on it, contemplation on it, and realizing, like, these other possibilities and reminding myself of them. And I've done, I started doing meditations on YouTube, and then I went to going to temples and being initiated into, like, certain yogic practices.
That's cool.
Yeah, with different meditations, with whatever, like, the breath, chakras, different breathing techniques, stuff like that, concentration. So that's a big part of recovery for me. Not everybody in recovery does a meditation by any means, although it is in the 11th step in AA and NA, but for me it's important.
Yeah.
For me, yeah. So I do pretty much every day. So sharing, talking, I talk about whatever I have going on, like, whether it's with my sponsor in recovery or a friend or at a meeting, I try not to keep anything in, you know, like, open communication.
Yeah. That's what I've reading a couple of Buddhism books about being present and communication. What the author Thich Nhat Hanh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have read a book.
Yeah, he writes some good stuff about, like, being present that I've never really considered the importance of. Before, because what you just said about going into your unconscious behavior, basically, like, your your autopilot mode. You start to have these autopilot thoughts that you're mm-hmm. not wanting in your head that may lead you into a relapse or into thinking like bringing bad thoughts and behavior, period. Being present and mindful keeps you in the now and keeps you present of what you're saying, what you're hearing, what you're thinking. And I never understood that before, like before I've read those books. And it sounds like it helps you keep away from the negative thoughts as well by staying present and doing. I think that's meditation helps as well. If that's a step as well in it,
yeah,
it helps you realize where you're at, right? And
yeah,
you're kind of like you're having a therapy to yourself in a sense, right?
Yeah, meditation is definitely a big part of it. Is the mind. And I like how you said when we talked before that. Those people like Thich Nhat Hanh are like masters of the mind, and they spend their whole life studying the mind.
Yeah, so what I was saying, sorry to cut you off there, but
no, it's fine.
To give the analogy, so these people too, like that write these books that we're talking about, they're not like, you know, Michael Jordan is like amazing basketball. He was an amazing basketball player because, you know, he practiced all the time. That's all he did all the time was practice that stuff. So. These monks and these people who spend their entire lives basically studying the consciousness and studying the inner workings of our minds and emotions and stuff like that. Like they spend their entire lives sometimes not even talking, mm-hmm. which is insane to think about, mm-hmm. but there's not a lot of people in the world that do that. And then these people write books and give advice about what they've learned over the years about the human consciousness. I mean, you're not going to get that from a psychologist who went to school. I mean, you'll get different stuff from a psychologist who went to school and graduated in like 4 years than you would from a monk who's been doing it for 30 years of his life. And you know, it's just interesting to think about that stuff. And then you like read what they're saying, and it's actually really, really beautiful stuff to live by. Like, I admire the way that these guys live is like insane to me, the way that like emotions and stuff just fall, like it slides off of them, you know, that they don't mm-hmm. they're not married to their emotions or get riled up, and they don't even like, it's just crazy. It's so weird that you could make the human body be that, and then there's people like us as we were young, or you when you were young, choking people and beating people and like doing stuff like that. But then with this practice and stuff too, it pulled you to who you are now. Like, you're so different from that person. That's why I'm so fascinated by you, honestly, because you just blow my mind, honestly, because your 180 is just, it's incredible. It's honestly, for people who are listening to this, seriously, like, take some of his advice, because he's walking the walk entirely. Seriously, like, I admire that shit, because I have a lot of friends who struggle with addiction, a lot of friends who've died from addiction. I'm sure we both have experience that in this area. So it's just, we live in a shitty area where, you know, I mean, the whole world's addicted to stuff,
and
it's everywhere, but I think learning how people manage with it is so important, just like you get from recovery and all those classes you go to, like learning different tricks and stuff, man. That's like, it's how we gotta figure it out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate like all the stuff that you do and like this, the channel that you make and the stuff that you put out is cool, for real.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem, dude. So like for the recovery process, like how do you get rid of triggers and stuff like that too? Do you have methods of just being is that just all mindful practice and stuff?
To an extent it is, because there is the idea in the big book that once we're free from our addiction that we can walk freely and like do what anybody else could do, to go wherever anyone else could go. But in the beginning of recovery, before people have kind of had that, that's one of the riskiest and most dangerous things, is they don't want to give up the image of who they think they are and their lifestyle, so they want to keep going to the same places, being with the same people, doing the same things. And like, you know, the way your neuropathways are wired in your brain, it reminds it. And even with years clean, if I hear gangster rap music, or even if I'm in an environment similar, smoking a cigar with some friends and listening to like rap music, I'll almost feel like I'm using again, because it's still in my brain somewhere. But I did like you got to be, like, I can go places by chance, and some people in recovery would never go to a bar or anything. I could, and I've been to some, but, one, I have no reason really to be there. It's not fun to me. I've only went for a couple birthdays or, like, to play pool, but, no, yeah, I did have to change my life a lot. I mean, I couldn't hang out with any of my friends anymore, and the first year or year and a half, I didn't at all, and now I could see them once in a while, but, it's kind of a fine line because I'm free from it. If I go around alcohol or something, I don't want to drink. But you can't underestimate the power of the addiction either because, you know, I have been around my friends getting high and I've seen cocaine before. And I remember seeing it and I was like, it kind of did trigger me. So I think the mind does carry it for a long time. I mean, for me, it was like everything was a trigger. Just waking up was. So it's like I'm either going to use or I'm not going to use. But I do think you still got to be reasonable in avoiding, you know, and like especially in the beginning. Like,
especially a lot of major temptation like that, right?
Yeah, and if you go around it a lot, then like, yeah, you're probably going to use, you know, like they say in recovery, like if you keep going to the barber shop, you're going to get a haircut eventually. And so, and like in treatment, they will tell you, you know, get rid of your triggers, change up your patterns and behaviors, which is smart to an extent, but you still have to do the more of the inner work if you want it to be a permanent change. Yeah, yeah. But like those little changes help too, especially in the beginning. But I do think it's deeper, like you were saying about the mind and stuff. In if you listen to Ram Dass or the Dalai Lama, they'll say that the psychology of Buddhism is almost like a psychology that makes the psychology of our modern like therapists and stuff seem like kindergarten or first grade.
Cause very, it's much, like, training wheel stuff.
Yeah. For sure. And they look into really the nature, not just about, like, thoughts. I think what a lot of the problem is with therapy now is it's, like, it's about reinforcing your ego identity, you know, and, like, defining who you are. Mm. And, like, if you listen to a lot of those books and talk to those kind of people, it's, like...
Interesting.
Yeah, it's not about... Really, it's not about the ego. That just reinforces your separateness, you know?
Wow. You're totally right, because all those books talk about how basically it all doesn't, like, matter in a sense.
Yeah.
Like,
they see beyond the things of personality.
Yeah, and the therapist wants to, like, dig deep into them and stuff and figure out why you freaking, you know, kicked your dog 3 years ago.
Yeah, and that's what Ram Dass would say. He was a therapist. He was a psychiatrist, a doctor in or psychology, and he used to teach it at Harvard, and he... had tons of people he would see and everything, and that was, and then he did a psychedelic trip on mushrooms, and he realized, like, basically it was all a sham, you know, and then he tried to keep teaching it after, and he was like, it didn't work anymore, because I felt like, he's like, I knew that was just all the psychological, he's like, but I knew there was way more than that,
yeah.
And we were kind of keeping people stuck in just that surface
interesting
layer.
Wow.
But yeah, that's, I think, what's so hard for people to, see through. It's so hard to see through my own ego and personality and realize that it's not what it's all about. It's so easy to get stuck in it.
Because they all talk about, like, a lot of these books, the most common theme is that you're not attached to your ego, and you don't identify as who you think you do, in a sense. And you don't hold on to your past in the way that you think you do. So, like, it's all about what's matters in the present moment, like in the now, and on your intentions, right? So if you have good intentions and pure, and you're making good positive choices for yourself and for others around you, it focusing on your dwelling on your suffering is not something that's going to be positive in your well-being. It's, you know what I'm saying, like you have to learn to, like, I think I'm kind of saying it right, but it's a lot to kind of comprehend. But they just tell you to, like, move on from it and build a better now, right? Like, build a better tomorrow.
Yeah, because you could spend your whole life analyzing your past, you know.
And how many fuck-ups you made.
And there was this Russian philosopher, Georgiev, and he would say, like, part of the spiritual path is that you can't... There has to be suffering, like, there'll be suffering in life, and you need that to grow, but you can't be attached to it. Like, you have to sacrifice the suffering. You can't hold on to your past suffering as your new identity for the rest of your life.
Because it'll be a cancer in your mind or personality or something that will fester you into crazy behaviors, you know? It's maybe what led me and you down a troublemaking path when we were kids. You know, maybe like holding on to our identity. I know as me as a kid, I was very ego driven. I was a troublemaker too. I was a little bully sometimes. I was very just all about my image, all about really what people cared about me, and I didn't give enough time to like think about how I cared about myself.
Yeah,
if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. I was so interested in like pleasing everybody else, and never took enough time to please myself in that way. And so, you know, lately, like after my years of growing up and stuff too, I've had epiphanies that made me realize, like, stop doing that, stop living for other people, and dwelling on like other things like that. You know, it doesn't do any good. Yeah, it doesn't do. It's literally like weight in your mind.
Spend your whole life stuck in it too. A lot of people do. You know,
how did you forgive yourself after like all that stuff? How did you just move on?
That's funny because that's what I was just gonna say. Is that I just read an article recently, or that someone had wrote that said like you can. PTSD can also come from acts that you did. And so the reason I say that is because...
Interesting.
Yeah, which makes sense because it's like the act is still occurring whether or not it was happened to you or you did it.
Makes so much sense.
And so I was like, wow, because I didn't really have... I can't say that a bunch of people did terrible things to me, but I did do a lot of bad things, which could be considered traumatic. So I could hold on to that and be like, oh, I have this and this and this. But, it won't benefit me at all anymore, you know? And that's why when I talk about these things to you that, like, I did in the past, it almost feels like I'm so, like, detached from, like, it wasn't even me. That's why I don't mind talking about it, because I don't feel like a thing. So I had to... Yeah, I made amends to a lot of people, and to forgive myself, I guess part of it was that spiritual awakening and working through the steps, and just realizing, you know, the concepts of kind of... what we were talking about, sort of like becoming more mindful and present through spiritual practices to accept things as they are and accept myself as I am and realize that really everyone's pretty much doing the best they can and so am I, and just the futility of holding anger and resentment against myself. But some people do struggle to let it go, and it isn't always easy, and like a lot of people will say praying helps, you know, giving up just a little bit as you can, cultivating compassion. But I've kind of learned it through spiritual practice because I have to be detached enough to be able to view myself just like anybody else. Like if you did something terrible, if you were like, oh, 3 years ago I like beat someone to death, I wouldn't resent you. I'd be like, oh, well, you know, stuff happens. He's a good guy trying to do better. Like hopefully you can put it behind him. But if it's yourself, you have so much more attachment.
You're right.
So myself, you're like, so much harder to forgive yourself.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. So it's really, too, about a lot of self-forgiveness, too, and moving on from that and accepting, like...
Yeah, maybe even more so than anything else.
Yeah, and you're not that person anymore. Which, that book, if anyone's interested, is called The Art of Suffering by Thich Nhat Hanh.
Art of Suffering.
It's a really, really deep, profound book that helps people, like, dealing on all levels of suffering and stuff, but...
I should read that, because I read a different one by him.
Yeah, it's really cool the way that he puts it, but it's really, like, you could think of it just as, like, a weight you're dragging around in the snow, like someone else you're dragging around in the snow, and like you can hold on to this anger and suffering, and like, but once you let it go, it just, the road ahead is still sucks and it's still hard to get through, but you're just dragging extra weight.
Yeah,
straight up.
Yeah, there's already enough suffering.
Yeah, you already got enough day-to-day suffering, like quit holding it and piling it into a big fucking bag.
Yeah, you know?
You gotta just like recycle it every day.
That's what I like about the philosophy of Buddhism, is that they say there is suffering. Basically in everything is what the Buddha said. Like, there's suffering when you're born. There's suffering because you're going to get old and you're going to get sick and you're going to die. And there's suffering because people in your life, you're going to lose. There's suffering when you don't get things you want or when things happen that you don't want.
Yeah.
And there's suffering even when you get what you do want, because if you're attached to it, it's going to go away one day because everything changes. And so, like, there's, if you attach, if your mind, like, clings to any, like, idea of how things should be, there's going to be suffering because everything's in time.
You can see it in everything. And that's why he said, too, about the fact that suffering exists means that good also has to exist. Just like light has to light wouldn't exist without darkness, and darkness couldn't exist, like, couldn't exist without each other, right? So it's the same thing with suffering and good. So he said that in any situation of suffering, it may not, there may not, you may not see the good in that situation, but it's there. And he says to learn how to find it. So yeah, say like your parents pass away. How the hell can you find any good in that? This one's a hard one.
Yeah,
but
no,
like, but you find that you, instead of suffering, you have to find, like, you know, like the good and
yeah. There's suffering in all good things. There's a hint of suffering, and in all suffering, there's a hint of good. It's like the yin and the yang. That's why I've been just recently studying the I Ching, like the Taoist Chinese philosophy, and where they have the yin and the yang, and it's like the black fish has a white eye and the white fish has a black eye. So you can't be all yin or all yang, and that's the thing, is like we want it to be all yang, which is the positive, but the universe is made of both yin and yang, and they're dependent on each other.
It's weird how that works too, because we get comfortable and reliant on things going our way and things that go like the way that we want them to.
I know.
Right? Like seeing a glass, like even the sayings that are in our face the whole time, like seeing a glass half empty or full. That's like a way to train your mind. If you can see it half full, you have to look at a lot of shit like that, or you're just going to be this negative person who's suffering and sees suffering in everything. But you need to like literally put on these different positive glasses that change your freaking view of the world. And start like practicing that until it's literally part of your personality and behavior. Like you have to literally ingrain that into who you are. So when you look at shit, like, oh God, my dog just shit all over my pillow, right? You could say like, oh well, at least he's got a good diet. He's got some good protein. Like,
No, it's funny too, because part of it is like the cosmic giggle. Like you do have to have a humorous and laughing perspective, otherwise things are too serious. You know,
right? You have to let go and just make the best of what happens. Like it's hard to say that, but when you like read some of that stuff, it's like, man, these guys like sounds like they figured it out. Sounds like they figured out a good way to like, I wouldn't say just be happy, but to not suffer, to not experience like terrible sadness.
Yeah, and a lot of them came from tough, like Thich Nhat Hanh came from Vietnam, and like when he escaped the country, like a lot of the monks there were being killed and persecuted, and all his people were dying in war and stuff. And even like the Dalai Lama, when he escaped China, there was like a plot to kidnap him by the communist government, and a bunch of people stood outside, like thousands, tens of thousands of Tibetans, like to defend, so they couldn't get
good
to him. And then he escaped, and then to India. But then a lot of them got killed actually in the pursuing weeks by like the communists. So, you know, they have to go out and live these lives, and they're like really practicing what they preach, because you know how, like, I'm sure he felt a lot of pain and suffering that his people who were defending him, and then they got killed, some of them, when he left. So, like, they've went through, like, those oppressions and stuff. And that stuff's hard, too, where you, like, you know, it's easy to be, like, it's easier for me on smaller expectations. But what about people when they can lose the expectations of, like, their security or their freedom, or, like, if political, like, injustice or, like, unrighteousness. And those things are hard, too, because it's, you know, like you said, like we want things to go our way, and then they don't go our way.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know what I'm thinking about too, is like if everyone just practiced this worldwide, we wouldn't have these like wars and things.
I know.
All we'd have to get upset about is like accidents and natural disasters.
I know. I was just
not any assholes like starting wars over what, or communism taking over countries, and
I know.
We wouldn't have to worry about that if everyone had this practice in mind. It's almost like, can you integrate it now, or is it too late?
I know, that's the thing about...
Was it in our ancient
yang.
History? Did our ancient ancestors practice all of this? Not ancient, but like maybe even pre-flood. Because ancient history, we're on this route to what we are now. So like maybe they practiced it, but like, is it a lost art? Did people before the flood, did like... You know, like I wonder how long this trails back to.
I think there's been a steady decline. If you look at two things. One, in Hinduism, there's actually four time periods, and each one lasts like millions or hundreds of thousands of years, and they slowly go down in time, and then they start over, because the universe is seen as like a revolving cycle in Hinduism, and they're called yugas, and then they fall within other time periods. But basically, the world degrades more and more as the yugas pass. Like in the first one, which is the most pure, I think it's called the Sat Yuga, there's everybody's like super pure, and there's not war, and everyone does spiritual practice and this and that. And then like as they pass, there's like continually decay.
Descending into chaos, right?
Yeah, and then they say, according to their philosophy, about 5,000 BC was when we entered Kali Yuga, which is the final one, which is the one we're in, where there is the most wickedness and delusion predominantly. And it's pretty long. It lasts like 432,000 years, so we're not that far into it. And then, according to their philosophy, at the end of that cycle, then the pure one starts up again. And they see the universe as cycling in that way. And then after so long a period of billions of years, basically the manifest universe like dissolves. And whether you could say it scientifically too, like how scientists think that there's a possibility that when the universe expands to a certain length, it'll contract on itself. So that goes a lot in hand with Hindu philosophy, because that's what they say. And then they say then it'll come back out again and there'll be new life. And there's like infinite universes. And Buddhism says that too. So it's interesting because it's like, the Dalai Lama said too, like if there was, if every kid learned how to meditate in a generation, there'd be no war, we taught all the kids how to meditate.
Exactly what I was, yes.
Yeah, and I agree. I just don't know if that is something that could happen or not.
No, I think you're right. We are too divided now. It's too, entropy has worked its way too much to where we're not just or maybe we are working towards a single mind as well.
Yeah.
Part of me thinks that, there's some good out of it, but part of me doesn't.
Yeah, it's tough. There's lots of good and lots of good people, and there's also lots of delusion, and it's, I don't want to say, people's souls are bad. They're just stuck in a lot of delusion,
Bad patterns or just autopilot.
Yeah, autopilot.
Like, how many people are on autopilot? I catch myself all the time. Just autopiloting through fucking life.
Yeah.
Through everything.
That's what the thing is.
Like, everything.
Yeah, that's the thing about being here now. Like, people don't get the concept, but that's what it means. Is like, we go on autopilot unconscious for a long time, and then you, maybe something will happen, and you wake up again, and then you go back out. And the more you, work on that, the less gaps there are in between, the quicker you wake up. But it still happens a lot.
And some people, when we talk about being present and being on autopilot, being present is so hard to do, and it's something that you constantly have to practice, especially if you've never done it before. Being present isn't I feel like what people who just hear what this means, what it means. Like, I think what it, like a good way to think about seeing if you're even able to practice it for long, right, would be to, I think I read something where you you try to completely clear your mind of thinking, try not to think of thinking, just no thoughts at all, and sit in silence, and try and first off, it's extremely hard to not have a thought pop into your head about anything, about even the thought of thinking, or mm-hmm. the thought of not, like everything is a thought, but to not only shut it off completely, but to be aware of every thought that runs into your mind, line them up in a single file line and be aware of which one's coming in, that is kind of being fully present.
Yeah.
That's so fucking hard to do.
Yeah.
That is so hard to do.
Yeah, to get to that insight and penetration is extremely
difficult
for sure, because really they're all just separate thoughts, but it seems like such a stream of connected because they come so fast, and it's
tough. Yes, and then you can decipher which ones are accurate and are bullshit or just weighing on you and baggage, and which ones are not, are just taking up space, you know what I'm saying? Taking up room and keeping you down, or negative thoughts. That's why this is such a cool idea to me, after this podcast, I'm seriously going to start practicing all this stuff. I seriously want to put this into
play. That's what it's about, the practice. I go to this, I've only been a couple times because it's shut down, but the Chicago Zen Center, and they just sit you down in front of a wall and you stare at it for an hour, 50 minutes. And
the only business idea.
Yeah, and real Zen, you don't even, full practice, you don't focus on your breath or anything. You just stare at the wall. But for beginners, they have you follow your breath just going in and out, 1, 2, and you're supposed to count to 10, 1 in, 2 out. And if you have a thought, you have to start over. And I remember the guy told me, he was like, most people in the beginning, he's like, they don't make it past 3, in, out, in.
Yeah.
And when I did it, that was true, man. Even if it was the slightest thought, even by a second or two, and you realize when you really be silent how much they come.
Yeah.
It was hard to make it past like three or four counts without a thought.
It's so hard. It's like literally just all your focus on your breath, nothing else. Like, and then if anything else pops in your head, cancel it out, right? It's extremely difficult. And if I even could do it, it's probably when I'm laying in bed, sleep, like, and it makes me pass out instantly. It's like a good way to get super tired.
Yeah.
And relaxed. But it's so interesting to think that, like, how many of us, these people who are talking about the benefits of doing this are, like, crazy. And how few of us have actually take the time to do this. Like, it's doesn't make sense why it's not more practice, yeah. You know? It sounds kind of crazy when you talk about it, but
I know a lot more people that know about that kind of stuff than put it into practice, by far.
Yeah.
You know, a lot more people that
like
can,
me.
Yeah, that know, but that don't. You know, it's a good idea. Like, one day I'll do it.
Yeah.
But then, like, when will the time come? Yeah. You know?
That's like life, man. That so many people have that one day, I know I got to do it because it's good for me, but I don't do it. Just like working out and fitness. I had that for so long. It was like a bug on my shoulder. Like, I know what I got to do. I got my workout. I know how to do it. I just can't stick to it. Can't get that routine, you know? Can't get that wake-up call. And you're right. It has, for me, it was like that, whatever you call it, the
spiritual
awakening. Spiritual
awakening,
yeah. Same type of thing, right?
Yeah.
That was kind of like the same thing that happened for me with the exercising stuff, but you're right. Everything has to do. You have to have that internal purpose. To light that fire inside to make you want to do something. You have to find that purpose inside, like from within. It could be something that causes it outside, but you inside have to make that like this. Today's the day. I'm doing it, and I'm also like motivated for it too. Like,
yeah, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
And I like how when we were talking about the like that the state of decay in the world. It's interesting because you know it's ran. A lot of the world's ran by whoever, people in power, politicians, stuff like that. And you might say, like, those are a lot of times are relatively unconscious people because you have to think, not that there's not good people and well-meaning people that work in those fields, but you got to think of the kind of people that want those positions, that get into those businesses, are people with very strong ego power structures,
yes.
You know? Because what kind of beings get it? You know, you're not going to see, like, a Thich Nhat Hanh trying to run for a president or a governor, you know? So the kind of people that get into those positions are more susceptible to corruption and that because they're, you know, like you're saying, you're not going to get the Dalai Lama running for state senate because he doesn't have that aspiration.
You're totally right, and that's also what scares me about just not, I wouldn't say society, because there are societies that I don't think maybe had this. And I don't want to necessarily talk bad about democracy or anything like that, because I think it's probably one of the best versions of society we have today. Not socialism, but democracy, where people, based on how hard you work, is based on how successful you're going to become or could become. Your chances of it are greater based on how hard you're working, right? And your skills and all that stuff, your level. So it determines on basically your own, how much output you're getting, which I think is also important. But, however, I think the society leaves these windows, these opportunities open that could be filled and mostly are filled with people who are psychopaths, like mega CEOs, people who like, really, like the globalists who really own all the world's wealth, like these people who are Jeff Bezos billionaires types of, like the fact that it could make room for those people to form and then have control scares me.
Yeah.
Because some of those positions take true, like a true, like you would be a more successful person if you were a psychopath.
Yeah, otherwise 100%. You wouldn't probably be in that position.
Yeah.
Exactly.
100%. Like exactly. You would be way more successful is a CEO as a psychopath. It's just facts. It's just like,
yeah, you probably
wouldn't
be there if you were like, you know what I'm saying?
If you were
had
really
like a
good-hearted,
genuine
person, you'd probably be like a low-level CEO to like a lower-level business, family-owned.
Exactly.
But to be a Jeff Bezos, you probably don't care much about homelessness. You don't care. Like, you have to have a
yeah, exactly.
cold heart for a lot of stuff, withholding all that cash. It just takes some sort of monstrosity to, like, what kind of personality has that much wealth and like you know, doesn't do does give back visibly back to society. Society's crushed. There's so many schools that need money. There's so many funding into these communities that need fucking funding. And yet you're just sitting there getting, like, sending them drone packages. And they're paying you, man. Like, it's crazy to think about.
That's the thing. And, like, the people that would give it away don't have it, you know?
So to think, like, the name of the game is, like, to be a psychopath and to work your way, like, you would work your way up, cutting over people, screwing people over, making selfish decisions to better yourself.
That's crazy. That's a very bold statement, but I think it's true.
Yeah. We've created almost a system that inhibits and favors psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
And they almost inevitably always wind up on top, in control of everything. But then it's just weird, man. It's just weird. And then you think, then you get into all these conspiracy stuff. You get into all these stuff that these people in control are doing. You know, they're running trafficking. They're running some crazy stuff.
That's what's the interesting thing.
I mean, there's people like Epstein who exist. And there's a lot more like Epstein. So, like, who knows where that is. It's completely off topic, but...
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about living in... on Earth as a human being is, like, you have to, you don't want to push away the things of the Earth that are involved in your incarnation, but also the benefit of spiritual practices, you don't have to identify exclusively with that, because otherwise you'll go insane. Like, otherwise most people, they either go insane or they have to just deny it all and put it away. Don't think about it. Don't talk about it. Like, I don't want to hear about that because it's going to make me too paranoid or crazy.
The spirituality stuff? What do you mean?
No, the crazy stuff going on in the world.
Yeah.
So, like, if I, you know, you don't, but what I've learned in practicing spiritual practices, I can't push things away and deny them or not acknowledge them, because otherwise it's got me just as trapped. I'm just not acknowledging it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like if I'm like, I don't want to hear about politics, it brings me down. Well, then I'm not really free because, you know, I can't hear about that. But I also can't get obsessed with it, or I'm also caught in it, you know? So that's why spiritual practice helps a little bit to, if you're looking at it from the perspective of a soul or eternity or infinite time, it just changes the perspective a little bit. So it's still very difficult not to get caught in it, but so at least you have these two balancing perspectives instead of just
being grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I know people who, you're right, like, go into the conspiracy. Once you learn about the darkness of the world, some people can't not only unsee it, it's hard to unsee it, but you can't stop falling down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, and then it's how do you live still with compassion and this and that after being exposed?
Exactly. To how do you see the world if you, like, you build up that wall of, like, just negative shit that the world is? You're going to start seeing the world differently. You're going to start, it's going to affect your trust in people and stuff like that. So you're right, like, having that spiritual grounding is probably important for sure. Is there anything that you can give advice-wise to people who were or similar in your position before? People who are basically, whether they were doing all the stuff that you were doing or whether they were just doing a handful of the stuff, they're basically, what if they're just doing behaviors that they want to break out from and they don't see an end in sight?
I think that it really is all about mindfulness and being present, and it's also about, one of the most important things I think is about, that I didn't learn until recently actually, is giving up your unworthiness. So a lot of times we, somewhere deep inside, we think that we're unworthy, like, to get better, to do better, to get out of the cycle, like, to stop being uncomfortable. And I read a really good book about that. It was called Gradual Awakening by Stephen Levine, and it talks about, like, Buddhist Vipassana meditation, but he focuses on chapter two on that, and not by, like, denying your unworthiness, but, you know, you could see it and view it and accept it, like, accept that feeling, but in that way, I was able to kind of let it go. And that's, I think that's important, you know, to give that up, like, because that's what I think holds a lot of people back. Like, deep down, we think we're not worthy of growing and changing and getting better. And
so, like, learning your worth.
Yeah, not in like an ego way, but just knowing that, like, you're just as capable of growing and changing as anybody else is, or anybody else was, or you're capable of being as loving as Jesus is. Like, it would take a lot of work, obviously. But I would say that, you know, that would be probably...
Just realizing your potential and what you're holding yourself back from, right?
Yeah, that and then effort. That and then, like, effort and perseverance. But when the work is put in, I think people can be surprised by how quickly things could change, you know? But it's tough, though. It's like you gotta love yourself and have compassion where you're at, too, because that's a paradox that I found in the... I guess I could lastly say this, in this Thich Nhat Hanh poem where he talks about the river and the ocean. Like, the river is us, and then the ocean is, like, enlightenment. And so a lot of people are striving for enlightenment, especially in spiritual practice, but you could use it as striving to get better or whatever. And the river is the us on our journey. And so a lot of times the river is preoccupied with the enlightenment, so it doesn't accept and, like, love and enjoy where it's at. So what he says is that you want to be both. Be the river, and the river is playing its role, and, like, it's here for a reason and reflecting the sky and everything. And at the same time, know that the river is also still inevitably going to go back in the ocean and get enlightened. Like, you're going to inevitably get better. So it's like you got to hold both perspectives, you know?
Like, learn to enjoy the now and basically... Yeah, wow. Like, I know that you're en route to enlightenment.
Yeah.
Wow, dude.
Yeah.
That's a really good analogy.
That made so much sense to me, because I used to be confused on that, and I was like, oh. Like, cool. So it's both.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's a good note to end it on right there.
Yeah.
Cool, man. I really appreciate you coming out and telling me your story, man, for real.
Thanks. I think
a lot of people can benefit from this. Anyone who's listening, you know, the author we kept bringing up was Thich Nhat Hanh and some of those books, but... If you guys was interested in anything, go on Alex's stuff. You got tell your shout out to what how to reach your stuff.
My YouTube is Becoming Nobody Alex Momcilovic, or you can just search my name, and then also on all other social media, Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram, with just my name, Alex Momcilovic. Yep.
Cool. And for anybody who is struggling out there, just know that there is hope. Let me tell you, he has done a 180 that. Anybody who knows old Alex and new Alex would be and probably is impressed. So, seriously, anybody out there looking to, you know, to even talk with him, hit him up. I'm sure he'll love to reach out to anybody who needs some help. So, everybody, have a good one. Thanks for listening to the first episode of the Matt Rich Podcast. If you guys enjoyed it, hit that like and subscribe button down below and share it with somebody who could maybe use this pep talk. Thanks, everybody.